Next on the program, we meet the master of Freud debunkers, who has written the book that he believes definitively puts an end to the myth of psychoanalysis and its creator. Since the 1970s, Sigmund Freud's scientific reputation has been in an accelerating tailspin. But nonetheless, the idea persists that some of his contributions were visionary discoveries of lasting value. Now drawing on rarely consulted archives, Frederick Cruz has assembled a great volume of evidence that reveals a surprising new Freud. He does so in his book, Freud, The Making of an Illusion. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Frederick Cruz to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, too.
I found this book utterly fascinating, and I'm curious as to what started your journey, because as you indicate, you were very much on the Freud train for quite a while.
I was back in the 1960s, and in the 70s I had my doubts, and by 1980 I was really on the other side of the street, and I've been off and on, I've been critiquing the basis of Freudian knowledge ever since.
So let us first wrestle with the word illusion, because I find it fascinating and also very appropriate in the story that you tell in this book. What is, in your mind, the Freud illusion?
The Freud illusion is that Freud, first of all, devised a successful method for curing people of their psychoneuroses and achieved spectacular results. That's one thing. And then secondly, in the process, he discovered fundamental laws of how the mind works, how the deep unconscious functions to distort our conscious life. If we look for these discoveries in the way we would look for anybody else's discoveries, we simply don't find them. We not only don't know when and where they happen, we don't really know what they are. So it's very much a case of the emperor's new clothes.
So how did we get there, and how was he ultimately able to create this illusion?
In brief, what Freud did was, first of all, to tell an awful lot of lies about his success as a therapist. Toward the end of his life, he admitted that he'd never really cured anybody. He said in 1933, I have never been a therapeutic enthusiast, he said, which meant that everything previously he'd said about his cures was simply false. But I think the most important thing is that Freud turned himself into an utterly charming fictional figure along the lines of Sherlock Holmes. He depicted himself in his case histories as a man who had made unbelievably astute inferences based on very little evidence. And this gave readers the same kind of vicarious thrill that one gets from reading the Holmes stories. Interestingly enough, Conan Doyle was one of Freud's favorite writers. He would stay up at night reading Sherlock Holmes mystery stories. And I think that this image of Freud as an almost superhuman master of ratiocination is something that dies very hard. People don't want to get rid of this illusion. But the fact is that Freud is not the hero of a Sherlock Holmes story. He is the author.
It is one of the most fascinating aspects of the book, because we talk about the making of this Freud illusion. But much of this, of course, is Freudians who you believe have given Freud the benefit of the doubt at every turn. It does not mean that there has not been an enormous body of published work on Freud. There has. But because it is done, in your opinion, by Freudians who tend to look the other way, and it is a fascinating, I think, a fascinating look in your work, in your book, to point to the lengths that these partisans have gone in order to not only, of course, spare their own reputations, but also that of Sigmund Freud.
That's a kind of sub-theme of my book. You know, Freud died in 1939, and the psychoanalytic movement was reconstituted westward after World War II. And Anna Freud in particular, but others, most notably Ernest Jones, really felt that they had to burnish the reputation of the dead master. And that's what they did in the 1950s in various ways, publishing letters that were extremely Baudelaireized, publishing a standard edition that was done very much in cahoots with Anna's wishes, and above all, creating Ernest Jones's biography of 1953 to 1957, which was supervised chapter by chapter by Anna. She had to approve every word of it. And what they did was to create a legend of a man with almost superhuman powers, but also an ethical giant who really did nothing in his own self-interest, but sacrificed himself for bringing knowledge to humanity in this kind of Promethean way. The Jones biography is a very eloquent book, and it's very convincing because, thanks to Anna Freud, Jones was in possession of documents that nobody else had, and these documents are incredibly revealing. But what was then done with the documents was to salt them away in the American Library of Congress under embargoes that prevented them from being read by anybody else, so that the Jones-Anna Freud version of Sigmund Freud was pretty much protected from revision for many, many years. Now, finally, some of these documents have expired in their censorship, and we're simply learning a great deal more about Freud now.
One of the other things that I found really interesting in the book is we can look at this now of your work that has dressed some of these fallacies in his work and brought up these essential questions. But you point out that even at the time, there were those who turned against him because they didn't believe and just thought what he was doing didn't add up.
Absolutely. Freud's contemporaries saw right through him. And there are brilliant critiques of Freud dating from the 1890s and the early 20th century that were then kind of forgotten when the psychoanalytic propaganda machine got into full gear around 1915 or so. So we can go back and do a kind of sociology of the history of medicine and find that a lot of people, Pierre Janet, for example, Albert Mohl, quite a few others, had made a fundamental critique of the basis of knowledge that Freud was alleging. And really, what they understood was that Freud had deceived himself by failing to allow for the suggestions that he was imparting to his patients. In other words, Freud thought, or at least he maintained, that his patients' belief in his own theories showed that the theories were correct. Whereas, of course, what was happening was, in a quite unequal relationship between patients and therapists, the patients' ideas were essentially being used to brainwash the patients. So there's no legitimacy to these conclusions. And what we need to do is to go back to what Freud's contemporaries already knew quite well.
You say in the book that ultimately he really never cured anyone.
He certainly never cured anyone of a psychological disorder, no. And obviously the burden of proof is on him. When we look at the published case histories, they are pretty much confessions of failure just on their face. But in addition, Freud actually invented patients. There are at least two cases in which the patients whom he claims to have cured or at least brilliantly understood didn't exist at all. And when we understand that and then reread these case histories, what we see is a brilliant use of rhetoric for portraying Freud as the Sherlock Holmes of his generation. And, you know, from a medical or scientific point of view, this is simply fraud. This is a basis for disbarment.
Describe a little bit how he betrayed the mentors who ultimately helped him to rise to the great heights that he was able to rise to.
The prime example is Joseph Breuer, who was his elder guide and friend for a number of years and who really helped him to set up his quite lucrative practice in Vienna. Breuer had had a patient named Bertha Pappenheim, now famously known as Anna O, from 1880 to 1882. She had suffered from what seemed to be hysteria over that period, and Freud and Breuer had discussed her case years afterwards, and it occurred to Freud at a time when he really needed to make himself famous and had no basis for doing so, that if he and Breuer together could revive the Anna O case and present it as a great therapeutic success, that would enable Freud to kind of sit on the shoulders of Breuer and claim that the two of them had made a method that could cure any hysteric. Now, there are many, many problems with this case, but I'll just get to the bottom line, which was that Breuer himself addicted Bertha Pappenheim to morphine, and her main problem was not hysteria. It was a double addiction to two drugs, one of which was morphine. And by the end of the treatment in 1882, Breuer had committed her to an institution for the cure of her morphine addiction. So the whole business about curing hysteria was a complete lie. Now, while this was going on, Freud and Breuer were at odds over theoretical matters, and Freud gradually recast the Anna O case in a way to denigrate Breuer. He wanted the case to illustrate his own sexual theory, and so what he did was to say that at the end of the treatment, Anna O was madly in love with Breuer and had a hysterical pregnancy, fantasizing that she was carrying Breuer's child. And he broadcast this theory, this lie, really, to his disciples who spread it. And it became the canonical version of the case. It's there in the Jones biography. But it's a complete falsehood, and it's a great slander on a man who had done everything he could to help out Freud.
You used the term a few moments ago, on the shoulders, and it is something that obviously comes to mind as you read the book. Of we are still seeing those who are riding on the shoulders of Freud even today, and I'm interested in that impact and what this ultimately says about those who are still practicing and still have these beliefs that were perpetrated by Freud decades and decades ago.
Well, if you talk to any psychoanalyst today, you will be told that we have gone way beyond Freud. We've left Freud behind. He was the founder. He gave us some basic ideas, but we're doing a lot better now. Now, in actuality, there are many, many schools of psychoanalysis, and the reason for that is that the concepts that are used are so vague that it's impossible to adjudicate between them. So it just becomes a power game between psychoanalysts. Anyone can set up a school of psychoanalysis and say, I'm inspired by Freud, but I've discovered these things through my own work, and we're leaving Freud behind now. What's interesting to me is that Freud continues to be the kind of logo for this activity, and yet no one can say exactly what it is that was right about Freud and what it is that was wrong about Freud. They all disagree on these points, so they pick and choose. But the use of Freud as a kind of a statue of a dignified founder theory legitimizes whatever it is that psychoanalysts are doing now. One doesn't know what they're doing because one, you know, isn't behind closed doors. And I would emphasize that it may be perfectly true that a given psychoanalyst is behaving admirably and providing good services for fees, for patients, for all kinds of causes. But the connection with Freud is, to say the least, very tenuous.
Frederick Cruz is the author of the new book, Freud, The Making of an Illusion. The book is published by Metropolitan Books. Frederick Cruz, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's my pleasure indeed.
Thank you very much. Again, okay. The name of the book is Freud, The Making of an Illusion. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.